everyone, and welcome to Energy Unplugged. This is your host, Stuart Weedeye, and I've got my co-host, Mark Denton, with me today. Mark, how you doing?
Good morning. Doing great.
Anything interesting happen in your world of energy in the past week or two?
Well, I'm down in sunny South Florida, and everything's beautiful down here.
Well, a lot of folks up in the Midwest where it's 7 degrees might enjoy that type of weather that you're seeing right now.
Yes.
Well, at Energy Unplugged, we aim to inform and help people understand the various things of the energy world. And we focus not just on dreams and aspirations, but facts, reality, and technological innovations that are going to help our country and our world make a positive effect on the climate, the environment, but also have energy that works for the citizens of the world, but really in our United States here. So we are really pleased and excited to have Jonathan Overly with us today as our guest. Jonathan is the executive director of the East Tennessee Clean Fuels Coalition, which is associated with the Department of Energy. And Jonathan, if you wouldn't mind taking a moment just to introduce yourself, welcome.
Yeah, good morning, fellas, and very much appreciate the invitation. I am recently 52, so I've just gone over that hump and dealing with things from that perspective in life, but I've spent about 20 years running the East Tennessee Clean Fuels Coalition. I still remember in like 2001 when my boss at the time at UT in a research group said, Jonathan, this clean cities thing, have you ever heard of that? And my reaction was, what is that, like inner city trash pickup? Why am I going to be interested in that? I mean, I actually had the same reaction that some other people do with the name. And after about 2 weeks of looking at it, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And that's what started me on the course of trying to start a small business and then build a group of people around kind of, as we can, transform the transportation industry to be a little bit cleaner, use more American products. And it took a long time. One of the things I say nowadays is the worst thing you can do is let somebody with 2 engineering degrees start a company. And I have lived in the frying pan for 20 years. And so that's been great because, boy, have I learned a lot about business, at least from the small business perspective and managing employees. And it's a constantly learning environment. But I thoroughly enjoy it. And we now have, I guess it's 3 full-time staff and a couple of interns that work with East Tennessee Clean Fuels. We started out with just one person, me. In our case, we're kind of connected at the hip with the University of Tennessee because we have the 501c3 East Tennessee Clean Fuels Coalition has a contract with UT for employment. So all of us are UT employees, but we spend full-time working for the coalition. But yeah, we've grown over time, and one of the things that to me is the most rewarding is just all the people we get to meet, like you guys. I mean, they're just across the different fuels and across Tennessee and beyond, we get to meet great people that have a passion for some of this stuff to try to take action.
Yeah, that's great. And Jonathan, is you're one of the more respected and I will say successful clean cities around the country. What are the maybe, as you said, you've been at this for 20 years, and I believe somewhere in 2003 or 2004 that you got an official designation from the Department of Energy. Could you explain a little bit what the Department of Energy Clean Cities Program is all about?
Sure. It started back in 1993. The greater metropolitan area of Atlanta was the first clean cities, quote unquote, coalition to come to fruition. It's now up to a number that's, I think it's something between 85 and 90. But the intent was to help, you know, communities, whether your coalition covers a metropolitan area or a state or whatever the region may be, start working on diversifying away from just gasoline and diesel alone. And they, for so long, they've just, you know, it's just petroleum use reduction is what it's been kind of coined at. And then along the way, DOE came up with this, you know, relatively long list of approved alternative fuels. And of course, propane is one of those and has been one of those for since inception. But there's these 85 coalitions across the country, and each of us just work within our region to try to develop relationships and get people to move to using these fuels. The primary basis in that is human health perspectives. and reducing pollution next to humans. And so there's a reason why it started with cities, as you think of more pollution and more people. But it really is everywhere. The United States has a major gasoline and diesel addiction, and so we've got to transform that. We've been working on that for eons, and all those coalitions work on that with various partners across the fuels.
Well, you know, Jonathan, you just mentioned something that's very intriguing to me, and I'm encouraged to hear you say it, that part of your mission is to improve human health conditions. And there's a lot of talk, and there should be, about the climate and the earth itself, and we all need to be good stewards of the earth itself, but we also need to be considerate of the human health impacts that transportation has on people's lives. So do you want to elaborate a little bit more about that and how that mission that you all are fulfilling is dealt with in regards to the alternative fuels and the programs that you have?
Absolutely. And, you know, you guys know this, but the easy relational item for a lot of people to get them to understand this is, so why are there propane forklifts inside industrial complexes across the country and across the world? Because they reduce carbon monoxide emissions substantially compared to using something like gasoline inside a facility. Mm-hmm. So that's just one example of a human health impact. It started a long time ago, but each of these fuels, you know, provides different kind of criteria pollutant, the main EPA list of pollutants that are out there that aren't greenhouse gas emissions. And there's about six or seven of them. But carbon monoxide, particulate matter of different sizes, nitrogen oxides is very important nowadays. But the more we can reduce those, the more we reduce the impacts they have on the people. And just one quick point, I was doing a little summary the other day, and it's funny, you hear stories about propane school buses in, you know, different states and cities, and some city orders 100 or 300. And, you know, Tennessee has just not been that way. And I don't see us getting to the 200 orders unless we get, like, the city of Memphis completely changing their contract. But I was totaling up for the 15 different counties or school districts in Tennessee. We are now up to 94 propane buses. So that makes me really happy, because I know one of the groups of people that we want to improve human health impacts for is our kids, because we know our immune systems are really not fully developed until we get into the late teens. And then also when we get older in life, like I'm approaching, we...
You're getting into the last quarter or the last third at least, right?
That's right. And so we know some things about how people are impacted, but it really buoys me to know that we're really making a difference for some of the kids in Tennessee with propane school buses. And that's one thing that's been a focus of ours for a few years that we love. But the impetus behind that is knowing that we're trying to improve the health of those kids.
That's really encouraging, as I mentioned, Jonathan, because there seems to be two obsessions right now. And neither one of them are wrong, but they are to the exclusion of other more as important things. One is decarbonization, but as you mentioned, what about nitrogen oxide and particulate matter and what I call black carbon or soot and the air that children are breathing on school buses? So it sounds like you all are taking a broader, more holistic approach as opposed to just decarbonization with your efforts in East Tennessee and in your coalition, which, by the way, I think the area that you serve is, you know, 3 million plus people. Is that accurate?
That's right. There's two DOE Clean Cities programs in the state that are both 501c3s, East and Middle West Tennessee Clean Fuels. That's one other coalition. And together we split the state. So we each have some number. And Middle West has Nashville and Memphis, so they probably have a little bit more. You're probably right. We have 3 million. They have 4 million or something like that. But we work together across the state. And it's a lot of people to try to help.
It really is. So that's again, very encouraging. I'm happy to hear that, particularly with a lot of the children riding school buses today and the diesel fumes that are coming out. So would you mind sharing a little bit about some of the more successful programs? You've mentioned school buses, and I know autogas is certainly part of your portfolio, but the electric vehicle programs seem to have a fair amount of momentum. Do you have any, what, you know, successful projects that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Let me answer that question, but just also add, I think it's going to take all of these fuels, and it's going to be a long time. If you have worked much with fleets and fleet managers, you come to understand that they come in all types and sizes, and that includes open mines and closed mines and just about every degree in between. Mm-hmm. And so you have to find fuel solutions for some fleets that will meet them kind of halfway. You can't just say, here, use electric, go forth and make it all electric. That is just not going to work for 98% of American fleets. Can they implement electric vehicles for some of their stuff? Sure. Is propane a better solution for certain sizes and types of vehicles? Absolutely. Might biodiesel be a solution for part of the fleet? That could be true too. So each of these, we want to stay fuel diverse, because I don't want to go to a private fleet or a public fleet with one idea in mind. If I've got a whole suite of opportunities and solutions, I think we have a lot better chance of them taking action and doing something.
Well, the operating profiles of fleets are different, to your point. Some can't operate properly if they only can go 100 to 150 miles, or they have load carrying capacity. And others, an electric vehicle might be perfectly appropriate. But your approach is related to their multiple paths, multiple solutions, but we want to make progress. I assume that's what you're sort of saying, right?
If at the end of the day, I'm not helping somebody do something different, then why am I doing what I'm doing?
Yeah.
So yeah, I've got to have the more I have a healthy set of options for someone, the better my chances are of getting them to take action.
Well, Jonathan, you talk about those fleets, and you know, the school bus, for example, that fleet manager already has a lot of problems to deal with. We don't need to add something else that is not going to not only improve health, but it's also going to save him money. That's the green that every fleet manager is interested in. And the school bus, it's been really interesting to work with school bus to find out that on the average, they're saving about $3,000 per year per school bus from comparing a diesel to a propane bus. So that's pretty significant.
Yeah, when you look at the duty cycle of a school bus, it's the perfectly wrong example of something that needs to be able to deal with the emissions control systems that are on the back of a diesel version. And it's just, and the headaches that have been removed by coming along with the technology like propane for school buses have been huge. And I've got so many fleet managers that are going, why didn't I do this before? This is fantastic. So it's a combination of, first of all, you know, a great fuel, but then also having some people. Bluebird and Roush is an example. We could talk about, you know, International and Thomas Built too in terms of school buses, but coming up with the right engine and system so that it will do what the bus driver expects, and then save the county or the district and the fleet manager a bunch of headaches and money. So everybody we've seen has been quite thrilled with theirs so far.
You know, Jonathan, and there are always transitions to go through, glitches when you implement a new program. And I know in Alliance Autogas, we've experienced that, and we are committed in our company to continue to make sure the project is going to be successful. So there's a positive experience, but there's a lot of reluctance. We often say our existing customers don't know why everybody doesn't do this. And then some of the prospects that we're speaking with think this is too good to be true. And so the status quo, we often say, is one of our obstacles. And you made a reference that, you know, you have all different shapes and sizes of fleet managers and owners and so forth. Is that something that you face, the obstacle of the status quo?
It is. And it's one of the stories I tell. You know, I'll try to be quick with this, but two examples of school district stories. This took about 2+ years for this to happen, but there was one county fleet in East Tennessee. And if you met this fleet manager, you would just think he is the prototypical curmudgeon school district fleet manager, probably not going to be very open-minded. And he ended up at a meeting we had in Morristown, and there just happened to be 3 or 4 different fleets that used different kinds of propane vehicles at that. And it was shock and awe for him in hearing about one fleet that was using propane mowers and how, oh yeah, the they loved them and they did all this, and they just had to watch on certain big hills where, but otherwise it was fantastic in creating cost savings. There was a school district, there was a work truck fleet there, and over about a year and a half of talking to him, he came around and now has 6 propane school buses, and everything has been going well for him. So that's an example of somebody that kind of got over the hump. There was another school district just in the last 2 months that there's a grant funded program that we manage, and they applied for diesel buses, and they just noted that they might be interested in learning more about propane in the future. Well, I kind of hit the accelerator, and over about 3 weeks was educating them to the opportunity. The fleet manager, the transportation supervisor, got really excited about it, talked to a couple of other transportation supervisors at other districts and heard from them, got his director of schools interested in it, and they were basically sold. They came back and said they wanted to switch their 3 diesel buses to 3 propane buses, but they had to have a meeting with the school board. I spent about 2 hours one night trying to make an easy 1-page handout that was updated on school districts that were using different alternative fuels across the state, of which the vast majority is propane right now. And he handed that out at the meeting, and he came back the next morning and he said, you know, the school district really just thinks that that electric is the future, and so they don't want to go with propane, and so we're going to turn down the grant. And I had just let part of me go and get happy that this guy was going to go propane. It was going to be another small success story and point of origin for building propane as a fuel that would work in a rural district. And bam, ran into a brick wall.
Yeah.
So that's just how these things work. And you have to be ready to continue the conversation. I think I don't even think that school district knows how much an electric school bus costs. If right. I could be lucky enough to be standing there and say, so here's the difference in the price of a propane school bus, and here's the difference in the price of an electric school bus. I think they would have all looked at me like I had a third eye, because they are so expensive. I don't think they know. And for the funding we were trying to offer them through that program, the money they were going to get wouldn't have amounted to a hill of beans for one electric school bus, yet it would have given them a significant, I think it was going to be about $20,000 a bus per bus for 3 propane buses. And the school board turned it down. So that isn't it. I mean, there are people of all different levels of education. And just because we live in alternative fuels and propane world and understand how this stuff works, there are thousands of fleets in Tennessee that I really need 50 staff to go out there and tackle that right. education aspect of what we need to do. And so we run into all different kinds of people, and that's part of the challenge. We just have to keep working on it. And the more I work on that school manager, that fleet manager, and his director to give them some more useful information, I think they might even be able to this year keep talking to the school board to where maybe we get them back to the table for propane school buses this fall.
Right. Well, and sometimes people need to do a little more investigation on the options they think, and maybe even the media is propagating out there that is a solution, everything now and into the future. We're talking with Jonathan Overly, of the East Tennessee Clean Cities Program Coalition, and one of the more successful Clean Cities programs in all of the country. And Jonathan, you mentioned funding. There's several things that you spend a lot of time educating fleet managers, helping them do evaluations to get away from diesel and gasoline powered transportation. What are some of the things that you all can do to connect people either to the proper resources or funding programs that may assist them in a transition to a cleaner burning and more domestic transportation fuel?
Well, I will start with, I won't say it's a direct quote, but from a fine young man, Mr. Stephen Whaley, who was telling me probably 4 or 5 years ago, a couple of good things. One, he said, most of the time when I have a conversation with the fleet, it takes 2 to 3 years in having that discussion before they go do something. And I kind of knew that and had seen it, but I'd never thought of it that way. So he helped me with that.
you know, I think really where you're going, and we experience this, is call it the long sales cycle, because people are unsure and they need to do their homework and they have to be educated over a period of time before their confidence level increases. So is that something you all experience in your work with fleets, Jonathan?
Absolutely. It takes a while. You know, it usually is several years before people will go from stage one, where they start working on that education, to actually doing something. The more it's a new technology, you start talking about a pressurized fuel, that's a little bit different. You start talking about something like electricity, that's completely different. And so it may take a while for someone to open their minds. Even biodiesel, that's another fuel that's out there. You really just blend it into the diesel and go on and watch for fuel filters.
It's a drop-in fuel, right? The biodiesel.
It's a drop-in. It's pretty easy, but you wouldn't believe how many fleets are still resistant to something like that when we've got examples like the Great Smoky Mountains National Park that have been using it for 20 years. So we have to take the successes we find and turn around and try to show that to the other fleets and continue to work on them. Some of them will be a little bit better sponge in terms of taking up that information and thinking about it. And others kind of, you know, it's not the most important thing on their desk. So it kind of falls on us to get back with them on a regular basis and see what they're doing if we really want to see them move in a different direction. And related to that, let me talk about funding for a minute, because funding can be a great tool to help people get over the hump. One of the things Steve Whaley one day was telling me was that he almost wished that the funding wasn't there, because there's some fuels, and propane is a great example, where usually you're going to see cost savings pretty quick. But for a lot of fleet managers to get started, having some kind of funding really helps them make a start and can help them prove to themselves, by having their own infrastructure and their own 3 or 33 vehicles, that, hey, this works. And then they'll have their own numbers instead of another fleet from Ohio or Texas talking about how they're having cost savings, to show them they've got cost savings from it. So now they can move on without funding. We always hope that funding can be seed funding. It doesn't always end up that way, but because those that are sharp, there's a lot of funding out there. The National DERA funding recently came out. There are individual states that have a smaller pot but have some state funds. VW's been around over the last few years. And there are other funding sources. Sometimes there are different state funding sources, or even municipality or large community funding cycles and opportunities. But funding can be important to help people get over a hump and get some personal learning experience.
You know, and Jonathan, you guys as the Clean Cities Coalitions provide a great tool for people that may not have the luxury of having their own grant writers on staff. And you can connect them to where those funding opportunities might be and get into those deep conversations about what do you use your vehicle for, how long do you keep your vehicles, et cetera, so that you can make recommendations that are the best fit for that application.
That's right. And we have some simplified payback period spreadsheets that we use. And as you guys know, there's more complicated ones out there that take everything under the sun into consideration. But oftentimes, you know, if you can put an amount on the maintenance costs or cost savings and the fuel and the capital cost of the vehicle, especially for the fuel over the life of the vehicle, you can give people a pretty accurate number if whatever you're assuming for those alternative fuel or the, you know, the gold standard, the gasoline and diesel prices are fairly accurate, help them figure out how they're going to have savings. And that plays into another point, Mark, and that is some fleets still look at capital cost only when they buy something. And I guess that maybe stems from the fact that if all you did was use gas and diesel and there's nothing different, how does it really matter if that fuel price is going to fluctuate anyway and that's the only fuel you use? But that's one of the hurdles we have, is not just talking about funding, but also trying to say, you know, you've got an opportunity for some cost savings here, but you have to look at the long term to be able to realize that. So we still run into some people that even if we show them $10,000 over the life of a vehicle for, let's say it was 10 years, but it cost them $4,000 more to buy the vehicle at the start, it's a no for them. That's just another hurdle in terms of education and trying to get people to do something we run into.
Right. We talk about a lot, the early adopters, you know, are the ones that obviously are out there first, that are understanding the value of what they're doing. I guess the question would be, how do we all move, maybe not the early adopters, but the next wave of people, how do we get them more interested in alternative fuels and give them what they need? I mean, where do you see the future of energy and transportation?
Oh, boy. I wish I had a crystal ball. But, you know, clearly, you know, electrification's coming on pretty strong. In certain areas, the costs and the cost savings make sense. In others, they don't. But I think it's going to be many years where we're going to need all of these alternative fuels to be able to make the difference that we want, either in terms of a climate perspective or to continuing to improve human health for the people that are near the vehicles. So both of those are going to be important. I don't know. I cannot remember the name of the movie, but it was like a 1980s movie. It was supposed to be in the future, and they were having a house party at the start of the movie. And you hear this like 1978 442 coming through the neighborhood, and everybody at the party can hear it. And the guy rumbles up in his, you know, ancient internal combustion engine vehicle and turns it off. And everybody kind of looks at him like, wow, you still drive that thing? And he goes, that thing's fantastic. And apparently it's 2040 and everybody's driving something that is a little bit more quiet at that point. But
well, we were all supposed to be flying around in drones by 2020 as well. If you go back 40 and 50 years, that would be kind of neat, I think. You don't have congestion on the roads. But sometimes the future is, to your point, I think, very challenging to predict. I always wonder about these trends and where we think everything is going. Because, for example, you mentioned the internal combustion engine. And something I also often comment on when I speak to groups is, today's internal combustion engine emits 99% fewer emissions than one from 45 years ago.
Yeah.
And the advancements that are continuing to be made, direct injection technology, turbocharging, other such things are improving the emissions dramatically, even from 3 years ago and certainly 5 years ago. And Bloomberg News has a headline in their magazine several months ago that said the end of the internal combustion engine. Well, I don't think that the reality is quite going to be as such. And it's not like people are not going to make these improvements. And we should be making these technology improvements. That's why we like to talk about that on Energy Unplugged, because the innovations that are taking place, not just with, for example, the electric vehicle, maybe some of the things that we've been talking about with the hydrogen vehicle as an option into the future, they all have these, it sounds great, water. We're going to run all of our vehicles off of water. Well, now, wait a minute. You got to get hydrogen from somewhere. And guess where it comes from? It comes from natural gas as a general rule, and it takes 14 units of energy to produce one unit of hydrogen energy, but it sounds great and sexy. So the future is very challenging to predict at times.
Well, and I'll give you a perspective for kind of how we're approaching this. So a large municipality in Tennessee recently had a grant opportunity. And what we did after sitting down with them when we were going to focus on medium and heavy duty vehicles was say, so let's look at the variables and the opportunities we have here. The funding did incentivize, if the way this funding worked, if you requested at least one electric vehicle, you could double the total amount of funds that you could ask for. So what we did is we leveraged that, and they were able to pursue 8 vehicles. I think it actually may have become 7 in the end based on just us trying to make all the numbers work. But what we ended up suggesting to them was, you really don't have much of an alt fuels program at this point. Let's pursue 4 propane vehicles. Here's how we're going to do it. Here's where the infrastructure is going to go. Here's who you can talk to about the infrastructure. Let's pursue 2 or 3 natural gas vehicles, compressed natural gas. And here's going to be our plan for the infrastructure. And of course, in that area, that can be pretty expensive. So we had to talk about that for a while and look at some solutions. And then let's pursue this one electric vehicle. As you guys probably know, you know, the incremental cost for the propane vehicles might have been 10% of the cost of the diesel. The CNG was probably a little bit bigger than that, maybe maybe 20-25%, you know, additional incremental cost versus a diesel equivalent of that medium or heavy duty vehicle. And then the electric version was over 200%. But the way that particular funding opportunity was written, we were able to kind of maximize their opportunity and hopefully get them on a program that would use all three of those fuels. Because what they're going to find out is, at least in the heavy duty sector, medium duty sector, the electric vehicle's probably not going to pay back right now. And we know that greenbacks rule in America and American fleets. The propane and the CNG, I think, will be able to show better returns on investment. And once they, if they get that funding and are able to, let's say, in a year and a half, 2 years, get all those vehicles on the road and working, then they can start having some of their own experience, be able to see how easy it is to maintain these, getting rid of all that diesel after treatment systems, how that reduces maintenance costs, and hopefully expand each of those alternative fuel programs. So, and they may go, you know, wow, this CNG is working great or this propane's working great. Well, we just need to do a whole lot of this first. And to the funding discussion we were having a few minutes ago, with the different sources of funding that are out there, fleets really just aren't keeping their eye on the ball if they are at least reading for 5 minutes what funding is about to see what they can do to help them get cleaner, more efficient vehicles in their fleet. So that's our perspective. And we think each of these fuels is going to be around for a long time. They all have a particular place. I can show you examples of different sizes or types of vehicles where a particular fuel works better. But we really need this whole suite if we want to see criteria pollutant and greenhouse gas changes in Tennessee from transportation and significant reductions in the next 10, 20 years. We need all of these in the on the plate.
You know, you mentioned Steve Whaley a moment ago, and Steve does an incredibly good job representing our industry, the propane autogas industry for transportation, on behalf of the Propane Education and Research Council. And, well, almost wish we didn't have all these incentives in the marketplace, but I think you made a point off also earlier, the seed money to at least do pilot programs to get the experience and find out what works for the particular fleet and what doesn't. That's the real advantage of having some of this seed money, whether it's a grant or some other program sponsored at the federal or state or local community level. Until we try these other options, we really don't know what works in the fleet, and we can't make the progress away, particularly from diesel. We need to get away from diesel and coal at a minimum. That's going to have a tremendous impact on the climate. But these pilot programs often lead to bigger programs. Has that been your experience, Jonathan?
Well, I think, you know, the example that I should probably pull out of a hat real quickly is the city of Kingsport. City of Kingsport, 2009 and 10, when Steve Hightower started going doing his homework, found a couple of funding sources to help get him started. And now, you know, I don't think he's had any funding in the last 3 or 4 years that I can remember in the middle of him taking his total number of propane vehicles in that municipality's fleet to over 100. So he's a great example where, yeah, he may have had several different kinds of funding as he started using propane in police cars and some steak body trucks and mowers. But then he's gotten to the point with talking to city council and the city manager and the rest of the maintenance crew that he has to oversee and understand that using more of these vehicles is a good decision. So he's a good example of seed funding. The other example we have is we know that there's some fleets out there that just go through a lot of fuel. It makes me think of Groom Transportation. I believe they are based in the Southeast and have locations that really shuttle people to and from airports from cities that are nearby. But they go through a lot. They put a lot of miles on their vehicles, go through a lot of fuel. And even if they had some seed funding early on, I have a feeling their cost savings are probably very high on an annual basis compared to if they were using gas or diesel, depending on the type of the shuttle they use.
Well, in fact, the mileage that they are driving in that particular fleet, Groom Transportation, which, as you mentioned, do take people from an hour and a half away to major airports, as well as provide shuttle services to colleges and universities, those vehicles may drive 100,000 miles a year, and they experience $6,000, $7,000, or $8,000 a year in cost savings per vehicle. Plus, they're using propane autogas, which reduces the total greenhouse gas emissions by 32% to 36%, depending on the vehicle platform. So there's a payback period for the higher mileage vehicles, to your point.
Well, and this makes me think of one other thing. So I think Mark was asking a few moments ago about, you know, how do we really make a bigger dent? And one of the things that's come along, it's been interesting to watch federal highways get on board in 2015 with trying to create alternative fuel corridors in our country, where literally it would just say, you know, on I-40 going through North Carolina and Tennessee, that, you know, this stretch of I-40 is a propane and a CNG corridor. And that's not going to, the purpose of those signs, they're not directional, is to just identify that that corridor has those fuels available. And if you think about how many people drive along our state interstates, we've, like many states, got very excited about this because, especially for me wearing my Clean Cities hat, that sign is not really going to do anything about helping them know where this is. But just in terms of them driving on Tennessee roads and seeing on most of the major corridors, this is an alternative fuel corridor, and there's going to be, you know, propane or LPG on that sign. That is one of those mass education tools, Mark, that I am really excited about. So excited that we actually created a group of the coalitions and state DOT reps across the Southeast called the Southeastern Corridor Council, where we're trying to share ideas across one another and make sure we understand what one another are doing and helping one another. But you're going to have a lot of interstates in the Southeast that are going to have these type of signs within the next few years. And I think when we get to that point, there's probably going to be a lot more people that at least go, propane in a car? I've never heard of that. And they're going to start connecting these, you know, and just like my wife, who's retired, drives around on in interstates in Tennessee, people of all different kinds, including fleet managers, legislators, city managers, drive on those roads too. So I'm hoping that that becomes one of those mass education tools for us and get some more people asking questions, really, to put it simply, to drive traffic to my door.
And, you know, John, that's one of the interesting things about the United States. There are more than 28 million propane autogas vehicles around the world and less than 200,000 here. The awareness is very limited, I think, to your point. And the corridors and the availability of refueling for both CNG and propane autogas, I think, could help dramatically expand the awareness here. And of ultimately the adoption, you know, we've lived in a really low cost energy for transportation in the past 5 years, since 2015, when oil prices and natural gas prices have been dramatically low for quite some time now, going on 8 years. Do you think that's had a dampening effect on the adoption of whether it's biodiesel or CNG or propane? And I don't ask you to pull out your crystal ball again, but I maintain you can't have these low prices forever.
Yeah, no, and it is absolutely true, Stuart. And whenever fuel prices are up, you know, when we went through the hump of 2007 and 8, and then really gasoline and diesel prices are pretty high through 2014-15, we had way more people coming and knocking on our door. I'll give you one example. There's one fleet in Tennessee that handles mining operations, not deep mines, like surface mining of materials. And they have sites across the state. There's probably 10 separate sites. They have some corporate sites. They have the mining sites. And it was about 20, you know, we started talking to them in 2012, 2013. We're making some plans for things to do. 2014 comes along, oil prices start going down. And it was probably, it wasn't until 2016 or 17 when, as I was still continuing to talk with him infrequently, he's like, we're not going to do anything, Jonathan, until diesel breaches 350 again. So, and he just out loud said it. And there are other fleets that look at it the same way. But if you want me to do something different, hit me in the wallet. And I am just like everybody else in America. If you want me to take notice of something, it's like getting a speeding ticket. And you guys have probably never gotten speeding tickets. And I'm not going to admit to the public on the radio that I've gotten more than a handful.
But we're not going to talk about that, Jonathan, today.
That's how you get my attention. And the same thing works with fleets. And when that oil price goes down, if it's higher and we can show them a greater cost savings gap, they just take notice faster. So low oil prices do put a dent in our ability to create that ROI and show the savings. And it becomes an onus on us to point to what are the factors beyond the fuel price that are the things that should be important to the people that are responsible for that fleet, you know, especially if it's a municipality, even if it's a private fleet that cares about the community they operate in. There are things beyond that cost savings. Now, that doesn't mean the cost savings is going to go away in the discussion. We just need to add other things that they do or should care about to that to get them to take that step.
It's a really great point. There's a reason it says the cliche, it's easy to go green if you're saving green, right? On the other hand, there is a movement, particularly with larger corporations and public companies, with the ESG evaluation, which, you know, your environmental impact and what sustainability programs you've got. Those are some of the things that we're seeing moving beyond simply a cost analysis or a cost savings benefit that the fleet can have. You know, you've been doing this 20 years, Jonathan, and through Republican administrations, through Democratic administrations. Yesterday, Joseph Biden was inaugurated as president. Is there anything in the political arena that you see could impact the work that you do? You know, we're joining the Paris Climate Accord again in the United States. So do you see anything at the federal level or even the executive level that affects what you do? Or do you think that the Clean Cities programs are out there just trying to fulfill their mission and their purpose? Is there any environment that makes it easier one way or the other?
Well, we have been very glad to see some increased funding through the DOE Clean Cities program coming down to the coalition level. A few years ago, there was a pretty significant increase in funds that we get at the local coalition. And that is one of the reasons we like have three employees today versus two a few years ago. And the more staff we can have to work on this and speak with fleets and address questions, the more of an impact we can probably have. So I expect that the Clean Cities program will stay, and we hope to see a further increase in that in the coming years. Additionally, the funding that can help us get fleets doing something is also very important. The EPA DERA program has been, you know, fairly well supported across the aisle for many years. That's just one funding program. Oddly, that is $54 million nationally. I guess depending on who you are looking at that number, you may go, man, that's a lot of money, or you may go, man, that's not much money.
That's a drop in the bucket in that.
That's a drop in the bucket. You know, if we had more programs like that, then I think we could probably make a bigger dent. And real quickly, I'll say that on the light duty front, you know, as much as multiple fuels might be an option, I think the ones that really stand out are probably propane and electric as things people could do easily and without too much of a cost hit. Of course, you're not going to go out and buy a Porsche Taycan and use that for a police vehicle. But one of the things I've been wanting to create in Tennessee that we've kind of had in the past, but not exactly, is what if we could just try to cover the cost difference or part of the cost difference of a light duty propane police car? And we could come up with the Tennessee program that would allow us to say if it costs, you know, $6,000 to make a propane police car, a gasoline police car, a propane car, if we could cover 3,000 to 4,000 or 5,000 of that, I think there's a lot of districts across Tennessee that we could get to go, hey, yeah, we'll try that. I mean, they've got their local propane provider in their community, whether that's a mom and pop propane shop or a much bigger company like Blossman. Hopefully they're going to get service and a good price on that. and they can realize the cost savings from it. So that's one thing I'm hoping we can find a way to create, because it's not covering 75% of the whole vehicle. It's not even covering more part of the cost of the original vehicle. It's a small amount of money, but we don't even have that right now. We really don't have a lot of incentive on the light duty side over the last few years, because Deere is so focused on medium and heavy duty.
Right.
W recently has been focused more on that side. So if we can work on the light duty side, there's just so many light duty vehicles in the city of Memphis, or, I'm trying to think of a good example, Merry Maids. I mean, there's all kinds of fleets out there where the vast majority of what they have is light duty vehicles. If we could start figuring out how to make some headway more on that front, I think we could go from what's probably in the couple of hundreds that are propane light duty vehicles in Tennessee right now to the thousands in a year.
Right. And you know, you mentioned the corridor earlier, the awareness that would be associated with having CNG and auto gas dispensers along the interstates in Tennessee. One of the advantages of auto gas, as you well know and understand, is the ability to deploy the refueling infrastructure at a very low cost. In fact, the suppliers provide it at no cost to the fleets when they want to have on-site refueling. But that is one of the great advantages of propane. And one of the reasons I think that there are 28 million vehicles around the world, you can deploy not only a reasonable incremental cost on the vehicle itself, the equipment to make the vehicle run on propane, but also you can get the refueling infrastructure out there. And it is an option, and it is impactful in the goals that we have as a country, whether it's air or having a positive effect on climate change. In addition to the cost savings that we've been talking about.
It's funny you mentioned that, because it made me think in those recent conversations I was having with the school fleet, where the transportation supervisor was, you know, over a few weeks really coming around. I could hear the excitement in his emails. And after about three or four where I was telling him, this is easy. This isn't difficult. It may be new and different to you in your community, and you may not see a lot of propane vehicles where you are, but believe it or not, this is going to be cost savings for you. And it really has a ton of pros with very few negatives. And he, at one point, probably our fourth or fifth email, he's like, there has to be some negatives. What are the cons to this? I'm trying to fish for one. Show me a negative. And it took me probably 45 minutes to kind of craft a response to him saying, you know, all of the alternatives don't quite have the energy density that gas and diesel does. That's one of the reasons we picked those. They're so dense. They're a liquid. It's easy to port. That's one of the reasons we chose them. So, I mean, if you compare propane, you generally are going to have a little less fuel in the same space that you would for gasoline and diesel. But 99% of the time when we're talking about a vehicle, that negative doesn't come to fruition, because especially on a school bus, there's so much room to put the tanks underneath. So it's not like there's a limitation for that. Now, if we start trying to talk about making an ambulance propane, that may be a harder issue, because there's so many tools, pieces of equipment, supplies that are on the back of an ambulance. If we try to take up some space somewhere beyond what we had as a gasoline or a diesel tank, it might be a little bit more sensitive. Although I know there's propane ambulances, they've found the space where they needed to. But it's funny you mentioned what some of those negatives were, because there aren't many.
Now, it's funny you mentioned that, because we are actually having great success in the last 6 months in the ambulance market for a lot of the reasons we've been talking about. But one of the initial challenges is where do we locate the fuel storage? They need the same amount of range that they have on gasoline or diesel more commonly with the ambulances. And we're finding those spots to put the vehicle, the tanks and the fuel storage on the vehicles. But those ambulances are on the road. They drive a lot of miles and they have a tremendous amount of idle time. So electric is not going to work because they're heavy. And diesel, we know with the emissions in a particulate matter. So they are looking at propane now. It's a market that we're very encouraged by recently that makes a lot of sense. And look, I am happy to hear that your organization under your leadership has taken multiple path approach to there. You know, if you have a community college that has vehicles running around, it might make great sense to have electric vehicles, particularly in East Tennessee, where you have so much hydropower, a clean energy source for electricity. And I always say electricity is not an energy source. It's only a delivery method for energy generated somewhere else. So you've got all the hydropower and you've got waste management vehicles. For example, CNG makes a lot of sense for them because they're on small fixed routes. But then you get into law enforcement, ambulances, people movers, shuttles, and delivery package companies that are driving higher mileage. The autogas solution makes sense. So we need to take an all-of-the-above approach in order to be successful and make an impact.
Well, and that's something Happy Fox and I need to work on a little bit more in the East Tennessee area, is talking to some of the municipalities or contractors that do ambulances about that as an option. Because I agree. I mean, that's a win-win if we can get an ambulance moving from diesel to propane. Should be cost savings for them. They're reducing pollution nearby people that clearly are sick if they're getting in an ambulance to go to the hospital. I don't see, and they usually do go a lot of miles, so that helps them create the ROI even when we have relatively low gas and diesel prices.
Right. Well, we've been speaking with Jonathan Overly, the executive director and fantastic leader of the East Tennessee Clean Cities Coalition. And Jonathan, we really appreciate your insights, the knowledge that you share with the fleet, municipalities, and government entities that you're working to educate in terms of using alternatives to gasoline and particularly diesel around your region, and also the impact that you're having on your fellow Clean Cities coordinators, because I know they look to you for help and assistance and guidance when they're trying to do things in their states and regions. So.
I appreciate the invite, and it's all about partnerships. We've got to help one another, and that gets me to a thank you to you guys, because Blossman and Alliance Autogas has been a wonderful partner of ours for years. Some of the stuff that's going on in East Tennessee would not have happened if we'd not been working together to get that done. So thank you for being a great partner at East Tennessee.
Well, that's very kind. We appreciate it. For Energy Unplugged, this is Stuart Weedye, and we again want to thank our guest, Jonathan Overly. And hope everyone has a great rest of the week.